even though he made it sound like something the people would really like, really he's got an agenda. And maybe there are those even in our day who, in the guise of wanting to help the poor and wanting to help the oppressed, aren't really interested in helping the poor and oppressed. All they're interested in is gathering power for themselves. And frankly, folks, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, I think it's all one and the same. How many of them will get before a crowd of people, take this book right here, and say, if I'm elected, I'm going to be ruled by this book, and then the decisions I make are going to be based on that? How many of them would do that? That are on a national level, you know, they're in the national spotlight. How many of them would do that? How many? I can't think of one. And maybe they really do want to live by this, but they wouldn't dare say that. Because if they said it, what would happen? They won't get elected. So here's where we're at. We now live in a culture. We now live in a country that if a man or a woman said, I really believe that book, and if I'm elected, that's what I'm going to base my decisions on, can't get elected. And so what does that say of the culture and the society in which you and I live? It is a mixed, mingled culture. It is the epitome of what Babylon is all about. I'm not saying the United States is Babylon. I'm saying that Babylon is in the United States. And Babylon is in Canada. And Babylon is in Australia and in Brazil and in Spain and Great Britain and Italy and in Russia and in Israel. Babylon is everywhere. It's a mixed and mingled way of thinking. And so they said, let's make brick. Let's build a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. And why? Because we want to make a name for ourselves. We want to make a name for ourselves. In Hebrew, the term name, shin mem, is pronounced shem. Shem. Name. Now, in the West, when we think of name, we think of Rick, Bill, you know, whatever, Sue, Joe, Ralph, we think of name. That's what we call him. But in Hebrew culture, a name goes far beyond that. When you think of a person, I'll pick on Rick. And do you think of someone that you can trust? Someone who over time has proven themselves? Someone that you know, if they say this, they mean it. Someone that if you're in trouble, you can call upon them and they will help you, if at all possible. Because if you think of someone in that sense of virtuous moral character, integrity, faithfulness, reliability, honesty, when that person speaks, you're going to listen to what they have to say. Because that kind of a person is going to speak with authority. And so that is in fact what Shem means. More than just what you call somebody, it's the authority that is associated with that somebody. So when we speak of the Creator, and it talks about sanctifying His name, that's about sanctifying His authority, establishing through your life that He is the authority. But the flip side of that is profaning His name. Profaning His name is not about mispronouncing Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh or pronouncing it correctly. Profaning His name is about profaning His authority. When you cause your son to pass the fire and offer them to Molech, He says, in this you have profaned My name. So what would causing their children to pass through the fire to offer them to Molech, what would that have to do with pronouncing or mispronouncing His name? Nothing. But what it would be doing is showing that their loyalties were to a false god, even to the extreme that they would give him their children, which is the heritage of the Lord, that you are showing your loyalties go to Molech or to Ashtaroth or to the Baalim or to what have you, more so than the Creator. In this you have profaned my authority. So all of that is to say, Shem, name, in a Hebrew mindset, means authority. So in Babylon, when they said, let's build a city and a tower top is in the heavens, and let's say Shem themselves, what they were really saying is, we are going to establish our authority. Why? Lest we be scattered abroad across the face of the whole earth. In other words, apparently they've got to establish their authority because we don't want to be scattered abroad across the whole earth. Well, that's interesting because when Noah and his three sons got off the ark, here's what the Creator told them. Be fruitful and multiply. Years ago, we planted in our yard a little flower bed. We planted some black-eyed Susans. I don't know. There was probably 10 or 12 plants that we put in. Every year, those black-eyed Susans would come back, and there'd be more of them. And as we got more, they spread out. And so each year, more, and they'd spread out some more. And they'd come back more, and they'd spread out even more than that. That's what it means to multiply in a Hebrew way of thinking. Not only are you reproducing and getting more, but because you're getting more, you have to spread out. So essentially, here's what the Creator was telling Noah and his three sons. Be fruitful, spread out. But what is Nimrod compelling the people to do at Babylon? Come together. In other words, defy the authority of the Creator. Notice how very shrewdly, how cleverly this all happened. Let's come together. Let's make some bricks. Let's build a city. Let's build a tower. Let's establish our authority because we don't want to be scattered abroad across the face of the whole earth. In other words, he didn't lead out with, let's rebel against the Creator. He appealed to what the people wanted. He told them what they wanted to hear. He came across as being someone who was a representative of the people, someone who was for them. But in reality, it was about his agenda. The reason Korah rebelled, you know, he went to Moses and said, Moses, you and Aaron are taking too much on yourselves. Aren't the whole congregation holy? But what he really meant was, I want to be the head man. I want to be the priest. And Moses saw right through this. But what I want you to notice is that Korah presented himself as being one who was speaking on behalf of the people. But he wasn't. He was using the people to further his own agenda. And folks, if it was that way in the beginning, and if it's been that way throughout history, then guess what? It's all of a sudden different now. It's that way today. So what is all this saying? If you want to understand the end, Ecclesiastes chapter 3:15 says this, and I'll paraphrase. If you want to understand today what's going on today, and if you want to understand what's going to happen tomorrow, then you've got to go back and understand what's already happened. Because God is the one who causes all those things that happened in the past. He's the one who causes those things to come back around again. And so if Babylon began to take shape in the beginning, and if Babylon is what's being really established in the beginning, then I'm not going to be looking so much at Rome as much as I'm going to be looking at Babylon in the end. And by that, I don't mean, again, an archaeological site in Iraq. I mean a mindset, a way of thinking, a methodology. But go over to Revelation chapter 17 real quick. Revelation 17, verse 1. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. First of all, this woman is considered to be a harlot. The word woman in Greek that's used here is the word that's most often used and translated as wife. So there is an implication here that she's somebody's wife. And since we have young ones in the audience, I'll be as diplomatic as I know how here. A wife is only to receive the seed of her husband. That's all. But a harlot mingles the seed of that lover and the other lover and the kings of the earth that she committed fornication with. And so what does she end up doing? Mixing all this seed together. That's what her fornication represents. And so notice, all the inhabitants of the earth are intoxicated with the wine of her fornication. In other words, the inhabitants of the earth are in this mixed and mingled mindset as well. Look at verse 5. On her forehead a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. So two things. Where is that written? Right here. And if it's written there, I'll suggest to you it was written there for a reason. Because, see, this is where the mind is. It's a way of thinking. It's thinking that, well, that's good, too. And we can take Islam and we can mix it with Christianity and we can come up with Chrislam. Have you not heard about this? That there is a, I would say, a fairly impressive movement right now within Christianity to embrace certain elements of Islam, and in fact to have ecumenical services with imams and pastors, and to take those parts and elements of the Quran that overlap with the scriptures in an effort to promote brotherhood and world peace and tolerance and social justice. And if I called some of the men's names, you've heard of them. Some of them are even calling upon Christians to cease from referring to the Creator as God or Jehovah or Yahweh, and for the sake of brotherhood and peace, call Him Allah. These people also promote things like seeker-friendly churches, purpose-driven churches. But ladies and gentlemen, let me remind you of something. Our mandate is to be a light to the nations. And you cannot be a light to the nations if you're acting like the nations. It doesn't work that way. See, the whole culture and society is compelling you and me to mix and to mingle. But here's what the Creator is saying. Come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord, and do not touch the unclean thing, and I will receive you unto myself, and you will be my sons and daughters, and I will be a father unto you. That's what He's saying. But how crafty and clever this all is, that even very notable and high-profile Christians are getting involved with this concept of mixing and mingling things together. Some of you are looking at me like you can't hardly believe what I just told you. All you got to do is look it up. You'll be amazed at what you find. But we can't act like everybody else if we're going to be a light to everybody else. Because that's what Babylon's really all about. It's a mindset. It's a way of thinking. And not only that, but Babylon, it says in verse 5, is the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And so where does all the harlotry and where do all the abominations originate? From Babylon. Not Rome. Look at something in the same chapter. Verse 3. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. And in the wilderness, what does he see? A woman sitting on a scarlet colored beast. That beast has seven heads, 10 horns, and 10 crowns. That's the beast. And the woman sitting on the beast. Well, notice that John was not carried to Italy. Do you see that? It doesn't say that he carried me into the Italian peninsula. Italy was well known in John's day. Rome was a big city in John's day. But where is John carried? Into the desert. Into the wilderness. All right. Babylon is the focus, in other words. Let's go back to Daniel 2. I bet you thought I forgot about it. What time are we? I mean, do we have a set time? Okay. All right. Yeah, tomorrow is a holiday. That's true. All right, Daniel 2. Nebuchadnezzar has the dream, like we said. Daniel has to go and have the dream too. And then Daniel explains the dream. And that begins about verse 24. I'm just going to kind of summarize it. He goes to Nebuchadnezzar and he tells him this. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, you're the head of gold. Now all these other metals that are part of this image that you saw represent other kingdoms that are going to come after you. So the chest and armor, that's a kingdom that's going to be inferior to you. Now historically, we understand that the Medes and Persians followed Babylon. So that's the chest. And then after the chest and arms of silver came the belly and thighs of brass, which is interpreted to be the Grecian Empire, which followed the Medes and Persians. And then we come down to the two iron legs, which everybody understands is the Roman Empire, which came after the Grecians. And then we get down to the 2 feet with 10 toes, iron mingled with clay, which is the last kingdom. And that's the kingdom that's present when the stone that's cut from the mountain without comes and crushes the feet and destroys all these kingdoms and blows them all the way as chaff is before the wind. Now, the last kingdom is 2 feet with 10 toes, iron mingled with clay. But you want to know what everybody focuses on in that kingdom? The iron. And because the two legs is believed to be the Roman Empire, and because iron is in the feet, that's why everybody believes the last kingdom is going to be a revived Roman Empire. In the body of Messiah, who's the head? Messiah is the head. We're the body. So do the legs tell the head what to do? Nope. The head of the body tells the legs where to go. Now, Daniel 2, for all practical purposes, what Nebuchadnezzar sees is another body. And who's the head of that body? Babylon is the head of that body. So if the Roman Empire is the two legs, does the Roman Empire tell the head, Babylon, what to do? What do you say? No. No. The head, Babylon, tells the legs what to do. The head tells the legs where to go. If the Roman Empire did one thing, it was this. It was to disseminate across the globe everything that originates in Rome. Because Babylon is the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. So I will submit to you that what Rome did just spread the Babylonian thinking all over the globe. As a matter of fact, even to this country over here, because the founding fathers, many of them were fascinated with Roman culture. In fact, that's one reason we have a Senate, because the Romans had a Senate. And most of our federal buildings, if you look at them, compare them to Rome and to ancient Greece and see what you find. And so that Greco-Roman culture came over here. But again, where did Rome get its marching orders from? From Babylon. And so consequently, Western thinking is mixed thinking. So now, back to Daniel 2. Rather than focusing so much on the iron, at least for right now, let's focus on another word that describes this kingdom. Can you think of what it might be? This very last kingdom, iron mingled with clay? Four times Daniel uses that word, mixed or mingled, to describe this very last kingdom. It has 10 toes, by the way, which are 10 kings. Just kind of a little bit. Here's what I want you to see. Go to verse 43. In Daniel 2, verse 43, speaking of this last kingdom, as you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mingle with clay. Is the word that is translated men. They will mingle with the seed of men. Anasha. It's Aramaic. The Hebrew equivalent of Anasha is this word. Enosh. Enosh. Now, Daniel's writing about the end, right? He's writing about the end. And if you want to understand the end, you've got to go back and understand the beginning, right? So go to Genesis chapter 4 real quick. Genesis chapter 4, we see that Adam and Eve had another son after the death of Abel. And his name was Seth, actually Sheth, which means to appoint. And then in verse 26 we see, and as for Seth, to him also a son was born, and he named him Enosh. Then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. So in the days of Enosh, men began to call upon the name of the Lord. Well, that sounds very good, sounds very noble. Problem, though. When you look at the word, or the text in Hebrew, the word that is translated began is a Hebrew word that means to pollute, corrupt, or to profane. There's a famous rabbi by the name of Maimonides. He's often called the Rambam. And he wrote a treatise on idolatry several centuries ago. And the basis of his treatise on idolatry is based on Genesis chapter 4, verse 26, when the word chukal, translated for us here as began, but actually means something that corrupts, something that profanes. So here's the point. In Hebrew, what it says, in the days of Enosh, then men profaned the name of the Lord. And do you remember what name really means? Authority. So what did they begin to do? They began to profane His authority. How do you profane the authority of the Creator? Just ignore it. Just ignore it. How about this? Just say that, you know, all those commandments that God gave to those people, He wasn't really talking to me. I can add to, if I desire, I can take away from what God said, which is basically why we have 38,000 denominations. Think about it. Most of those denominations believe that they and they alone have cornered the market on the truth. I probably shared this story with you before, but I'll share it again. I grew up Pentecostal. You know, tongue-talking, laying hands on people. People would come down to the altar and they'd fall out and people would be stacked up like cordwood. That's how I grew up. Well, it is. But see, I grew up thinking that if you weren't that, you weren't going to make it. I grew up thinking that if you weren't that, you're going to hell. Bless your little hearts. You've got a little bit of the truth, but you just don't have the bigger truth. That's what we thought. And nobody got up in a pulpit and said that, but it was very subtly impressed upon me. And anyone else grew up Pentecostal in here? The truth. I grow up and I meet my wife. Now see, my wife didn't grow up Pentecostal. She grew up Baptist. And they didn't do that kind of stuff. Did they? So, she grew up in a denomination that thought that they had the truth. And quite frankly, thought that people like me were crazy. In fact, some of them, I've even heard them say it, that that's of the devil. So here's my point. I grew up thinking if you weren't like me, you're going to go to hell. She grew up in a denomination that many people think if you don't think like they do, that you're going to go to hell. And then there's Methodist and Lutheran and Episcopal and Catholic and everything you can name. And everybody thinks that they alone have the truth. But every one of those denominations, mine included, have done this. Exactly what the Creator said not to do. Took away from His Word, added to His Word. Mixed. And how does He think of it? So what I'm getting at is this. In the days of Enosh, they began to profane the name or the authority of the Creator. How do you profane it? I submit it's not automatically an instant jumping all the way over here into outright and blatant wickedness. It is a progression. It's a process. You start journeying from the east, so to speak. You go and build a city and attract all these people. And if you're living in a city, that means you're not living in the country. And if you're not living in the country, then you're not going out there in the dirt and planting seed in the ground and watching the water make that ground fertile so that that seed can begin to germinate and then the blade comes up and then after a while it begins to thrive and it puts out shoots and then on the shoots grow blossoms and then the blossoms become fruit. And inside the fruit, there is seed. You don't see that if you're living in the city. And so if you're removed from that, then you start establishing your own rules. You start establishing your own authority. And when did all this begin to happen? In the days of Enosh. So then, if Daniel, in describing the very last kingdom of man, in chapter 2, verse 43, if he uses a term whose equivalent is this, and in the beginning, it's during the time of this man that people begin to profane the authority of the Creator, allow me to submit to you that Daniel, who speaks of the end, also alludes to the beginning. Why wouldn't he do that? Because if you want to understand the end, you must understand the beginning. The beginning is the end, and the end is the beginning. So this word translated began means to profane, to corrupt. Now go to Genesis chapter 6. Verse 1, now it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. Right? And then at verse 3, everything starts going downhill. And when you get down to verse 11 and 12, you will see that the earth was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. By the way, that word is Hamas. And the Lord looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, because all flesh had corrupted the way upon the earth. So it starts out talking about men multiplying on the face of the earth, daughters being born to them, and then the sons of God taking these daughters of men as the problem. First of all, when you read in the text, now it came to pass, 8 times out of 10, something bad's getting ready to happen. Next time you're reading, when you see, now it came to pass, look what happens next. Then it says that men began to multiply on the face of the earth. The word began. Guess what? In Hebrew, it's the same word that we read in chapter 4, verse 26, that should defile to profane. And so in Genesis 6, verse 1, if we carry over that word, what it would say is in verse 1, "Now it came to pass, corrupt men began to multiply upon the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them." If corrupt men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them, what would this insinuate about daughters? That they would be corrupt. The problem, then, is in the next verse. "And the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose." And so if these daughters were corrupt, and the sons of God married them, what has just happened? Mixed and mingled. And what is the end result? The earth is corrupt before God. Why? Because all flesh corrupted their way upon the earth. By the way, and I don't want to open this can of worms. Well, I guess I am. With all due respect to your position on this particular issue, I am not of the opinion that the sons of God are fallen angels who mate with human women and produce a race of giants. And there are several reasons that I take that position. First of all, you will not find anywhere in Genesis 6 where God has a problem with angels or even fallen angels. But you will find that in Genesis 6, God's problem is with man. It's with flesh, not angels or fallen angels. Number two, the theory that says the sons of God being fallen angels coming and mating with human women, producing a race of giants, as far as I'm concerned, has a flaw, and that's found in verse 4, because it says there were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men and they bore children to them, those were the mighty men, men of renown. In other words, if the theory is that fallen angels mate with human women and they produce a race of giants, Nephilim, how do we account for the Nephilim, the giants, that are there in the earth before the sons of God went into the daughters of men? Number three, the sons of God, it comes from the Hebrew term B'nei HaElohim. Do you know what that means? Sons of God. The term Nephilim means fallen ones. You see, the theory tries to make the sons of God to be the fallen ones. But the giants are the fallen ones. And they are there before and after the sons of God go into the daughters of men. But now, here's why I brought all this out. Because Hebrew is a very complex language. Context means everything. And things can be misunderstood and even mistranslated if you do not take the context into consideration. So, that is to say this. The word nafal means to fall. Nephilim can mean fallen ones, or it can mean those who cause to fall. So let's look at Nephilim in the possibility that it's talking about those who cause someone to fall. Because the Nephilim are these mighty men, men of renown. And the term men of renown is literally Anshe, a derivative of this word, Shem. Men of Shem. Men of name. But what does Shem really mean? Authority. Men of authority. And so these Nephilim are men of authority. And if it's possible that we could render Nephilim those who are causing to fall rather than fallen ones, then it would seem that in the days leading up to the flood, there were men of authority who were causing people to fall. Well, how might they have been causing people to fall? Maybe this has something to do with the fact the sons of God end up mingling with the daughters of men. Maybe they're being compelled to mix and to mingle. Maybe they're being compelled by people of authority to all of us need to come together and let's mix and let's mingle and let's coexist. Because who in the world today is pushing for you and I to mix and to mingle and to be tolerant? Those who are in authority. And again, they're not just asking us anymore. They're demanding it. And before long, they'll start legislating it if they haven't already. And so now, this is the point of the whole message. If we find ourselves being compelled by those in authority to mix and to mingle with things that the Creator says to be separate from, what are you going to do? In Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar sees this image, the head of gold, chest and arms of silver, belly and thighs of brass, two iron legs, the 2 feet with 10 toes, iron mingled with clay. And he comes to understand that he's the head of gold. But in Daniel chapter 3, what did he do? He built an image. And it wasn't gold, silver, brass, and iron. It was completely gold. 60 cubits high, 6 cubits wide, and he set it up in the plain of Dura. And so what do you think Nebuchadnezzar was doing? He was making an image of himself. And he was compelling all the people to come to the plain of Dura. And when you hear the music play, you are to bow down and worship the image. Does this sound remotely familiar to anything else you've read? What is the anti-Messiah going to do? Through the false prophet, he's going to do the same thing. Now, we read that in Daniel 3, there's these three guys, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, who do not bow down. Keeping in mind that these three guys are some of Nebuchadnezzar's noble men. They were some of his wise men. All this time, up to this point, they have been helping Nebuchadnezzar run his kingdom. They have been offering him advice and counsel as how he is to rule his empire. Daniel was doing that as well. Here's my point. These weren't men who were trying to topple the government. These weren't men who were trying to undermine his authority. These were men who were actually trying to help him run his kingdom. In other words, they were submissive to a certain point to his authority. But when Nebuchadnezzar made a decree that you are to bow down and worship this image, now they've got a problem. Because now this king has made a law that if I obey it, I will transgress another law. And so they had to make the decision. Are we going to obey God or are we going to obey man? Now, if we disobey man, it may mean that we're going to die. And so we need to make up our minds what we're going to do here. And so what did they determine? Even if it costs me my life, I will not profane his name. Instead, I am going to sanctify his name. In Revelation, we read about a group of people. It says that they overcame by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives even unto death. So apparently, to overcome the adversary means you have to have the testimony of the Messiah. You have to have the word of your testimony. You have to have the blood of the Messiah applied. But there is another component that's going to have to be in place. And it's going to have to be that you're so committed to the Father and to His purposes and His will that your life, if it comes down to it, is secondary. Now, there are many more princes of Judah that went into Babylonian captivity than Daniel and those three men. Right? Let's assume that there were more people at that congregation there on the plain of Dura. And let's assume that there were some that were from Judah. And if there were, and I think that's likely, but if there were, then notice that the Scripture only identifies those three. And what I'm getting at is this. If there were others who knew that you're not to make any other gods before me, any graven images of what's in the earth or in the heavens or in the seas, and they're not mentioned, then that would imply what? That they bowed down. Now, can we prove this one way or the other? No, it's not in the text. I admit that. But I'm just wanting to make a point here. If there were, and they're not mentioned, then they bow down. That means they made the decision. Well, the imaginary conversation I see is, you know, between these two Jewish guys, and they're like, well, man, this is a bad spot. What are we going to do? If we don't do this, if we don't bow down, then we're going to die. And can the dead serve you? I mean, you know, we can't serve dead God, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to bow down, but we really don't mean it. We're just going to kind of get through this bad situation, and as soon as it's over, we're going to repent. Well, if they had made those kinds of decisions, then they would not have had the opportunity to be tossed into the fire. And I want to say that again. They would not have had the opportunity to be tossed into the fire. Because you see, because those three men opted to obey God rather than man, to not mix and to mingle in this way, they got the opportunity to be tossed into the fire. And being tossed into the fire, they encountered the fourth man in the fire. Because you see, they don't meet him, do they? And if they don't go into the fire and the fourth man is not there, then Nebuchadnezzar doesn't peer into the fire and say, hey, didn't we just throw three guys in? How is it that there's a fourth man there and his appearance is like the Son of Man? And then he calls them out of the fire. They don't smell like smoke. And then he says, now I know that your God is the God of gods. In other words, they sanctified his name in the sight of all the peoples, and the most powerful man on earth comes to understand that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is God. In other words, if we are going to be a light to the nations, we can't act like the nations. We can't give in to this concept of it's okay to mix this and to mingle that. Because that defines this very last kingdom, and that very last kingdom is going to be crushed by a stone cut from the mountain without hands that represents the Messiah. Let's take a cruise. Anybody like to go on a cruise? Go on a sea cruise? All right, let's go on a cruise, and let's give our ship a name. Titanic. So we're on the Titanic. Biggest ship of its day. You can smell the paint. It's so new. Now this ship has got a unique design. The watertight door system makes it virtually impossible for this ship to sink. In fact, that's the way it's been advertised. It's unsinkable. In fact, when we were getting on the ship, we heard a porter tell a woman, "Madam, even God himself can sink this ship." Of course, I'm thinking, I wish he hadn't have said that. But we get on the ship, we set sail, we've been at sea several days, everything's going great, we're making a very fast voyage, try to make record time to get across the sea, but this one particular day we hear warnings coming in that there's an ice field up ahead. And I'm the worrywart that I am, I go and talk to the captain, and I'm, you know, is there anything to be worried about here? Oh, no, there's no problem, everything's under control. But nonetheless, we still hear more and more ice reports. But still going full steam ahead. We go on into the evening, and everything's very still. It's a beautiful night. But just over the horizon, there's something. Can't quite make it out what it is, but by the time they make out what it is, it's too late. And about that time, you feel this little grinding on the whole ship. And then the ship comes to a stop. So you're wondering what's going on. The musicians are still playing. The people are still dining. They're doing whatever they're doing. They're having a big time. Because really, most people on this ship do not believe that this ship can sink. But people are playing with ice on the decks, and it becomes very apparent, we've struck an iceberg. And so you ask of the officers, we've struck ice, is there a problem? No, everything's under control. The watertight doors are working. This ship will not sink. We're just waiting for some help. Everything's okay. And then everybody continues on about their business. Of course, by this time, I'm standing close to the lifeboat. After a while, though, it becomes obvious that the ship is taking on water. It's beginning to list. And people are starting to get a little nervous. In fact, they've uncovered the boats. Now, after a while, it becomes obvious that not only can this ship sink, it is sinking. So what must you do? What would you do? Get in the lifeboat. All right, so let's crawl over the rail and get in the lifeboat. We have come out of her. We're in the lifeboat now. Only problem is, the lifeboat is a little rinky-dinky thing. It's just this small little ship or boat, and when you look at that big iron ship, it's just hard to believe that you're safer somehow or another in that little dinky boat than you are on this big grand ship. So lots of people are still not willing to get off into the lifeboat. I went ahead and got in the lifeboat. Only problem is, lifeboat's still hanging in the davits, and the davits are attached to the ship. So even if I come out of her and she goes down, what's happening? I'm going down with her. So what must we do? Let the ropes down. Let the boats down. Let's get in the water. Let's detach ourselves from the ship. So now, we're down in the water, detached from the ship, but I just feel secure with this ship. It's just so big. Just hard to believe it could go down. So I'm out of it, and I'm separate from it, but I still want to stay close enough that I can reach out and touch it. What's going to happen? When it goes down, the suction is going to pull me down with it. So if I had the idea of helping all of those who are oblivious to what's about to happen, who would fail, who just can't bring themselves to think this ship is going to sink, and I want to help them, am I going to be able to help them by staying on the ship? Nope. Am I going to be able to help them by getting in the lifeboat? The only way I'm going to be able to help them is to come out and be separate from them. If I had an idea that when this ship goes down and all those people are foundering in that water, the only way that I would be able to help them, the only way I could be in a position to help them is to get away from them, to come out from among them and be separate, and then I could be in a position to help them. We cannot be a light to the nations if we are acting like the nations. As His people, we're not supposed to act and behave and talk like everybody else, are we? We are to be a separate people. In fact, He says, a peculiar treasure unto me above all peoples, for all the earth is mine. We are to be a set apart people. And in so doing, yeah, those people who lived in that mixed category that we were talking about, they're going to put you in the same boat as an Osama bin Laden. They're going to see them as extremists, and they're going to see you as extremists too. And some people can't handle that. Some people just want to coexist. Can't we just all get along? The reality is, no. No. I can't make peace with Babylon. Because Babylon, or the Titanic, is going down. And the Creator doesn't want me to go down with it, does He? So what is He doing? He's calling His people to come out of that way of thinking. Now, that does not mean He's calling us to come out to get our our wheat and our water and our shotgun shells and move off to Idaho and live in a cave. That's not what that's talking about. Because you're eventually going to go through all your wheat. You're eventually going to use up all your water. And when they find out you've got wheat and water, you're going to use up all your shotgun shells too. Doing that would effectively be taking your light and putting it under a bed. What does the Messiah say to that? That's not what we're to do. What should we do? We're to put that light out there for everybody to see. Because there needs to be a light in a dark place. But what I'm trying to get at is, the culture wants to suck us into this way of thinking. And we have to keep in mind that the adversary is very crafty and he is very clever. And so we cannot afford any longer to be as little children tossed to and fro by every wind of doctrine. We have come to the place that we must study to show ourselves approved. We've come to the place that we may, well, I say may just to kind of cover all the bases, but frankly the way I feel is we've come to the place that we are going to have the opportunity to make a decision just like those three Hebrews. To stand up and sanctify His name, or to bow down and to profane His name. Another thing to consider in Daniel chapter 2, let's go back over there real quick. Is the word mixed or mingled? Now this particular portion of Daniel is written in Aramaic. And so the word arav that we talked about, mixed or mingled, is slightly different. It's mem, ayin, resh, bet, me'arav. Now, if you were really paying attention earlier, I wrote this word on the board, but it meant something else. What? Exactly. In Daniel 2:43, this is translated as mixed or mingled. But the same letters gives us the word ma'arav, and ma'arav means west. So that would insinuate that at the end of days, there is going to be this mixing, this mingling of concepts and ideologies, and one component of it is considered to be very strong and one component is considered to be very weak. And in fact, they're going to find out that the strong doesn't mix with the weak and the iron won't mingle with the clay. And so if iron won't mingle with clay, and they do discover that, which one of those two do you think is going to win out and be left when the other is gone? The iron? I agree. So what has the West got to do with things? I'll give you an opinion. And I'll do it this way. Who was Herod the Great? Well, first of all, he was the guy who tried to kill the Messiah, right? Tried to kill the But Herod, excuse me, Herod the Great was not a Roman, and he was not a Jew. He was an Edomite, or an Edomian. He was a descendant of Esau, you know, who was a full hunter. And so he tried to kill the Messiah when he was first being born. He was the one who was trying to destroy the righteous seed. But who set him up? Who gave him the opportunity to come to power? It was Rome, or the West. And so you see the West collaborating with the East set the stage for a Herod the Great to come to power. So is it possible that at the end of days, before the Messiah returns again, that the West will collaborate with the East and set the stage for another Edomite to come to power. And so that's why this so-called Arab Spring, where all these different Muslim nations are experiencing these so-called democratic reforms, is so interesting, because of all the nations in the world, which nations are promoting it, are endorsing it, and are supporting it the most? What makes this even more interesting, see, is that the people in the Middle East, in these countries, Egypt, Algeria, and others, the people who are behind these democratic reformations, are people who have the same stated agenda where Islam is concerned, where the West is concerned, as did Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden wanted Western powers out of holy Muslim lands. They want the same thing. Osama bin Laden actually foresaw a day when the crescent would be over the White House. Well, they had the same stated goal. Osama bin Laden perceived the West as being weak and devoid of any spiritual value. Well, these people who are pushing for these democratic reforms in the Middle East, on their websites, state the exact same thing. So in other words, Osama bin Laden and these people who are pushing these reforms in the Middle East, they have the same exact goal. The difference is this. They use different methods. You see, the world is not going to find Osama bin Laden's tactics very palatable. They're not going to really embrace the idea of people strapping explosives to their bodies and blowing people up or flying airplanes into buildings. The world's not ready for that. They can't accept that. However, if you adopt democracy, if you embrace the concept of elections and freedom of speech and freedom of the press, that we can handle. And it's interesting to me that democracy, something that is associated with the West, something that Islam considers to be weak, and by that I mean the West, is nonetheless willing to embrace a concept associated with what they refer to as weak in order to advance their agenda, which they consider to be strong. Or shall we say, iron mingled with clay. But in the end, what do they discover? That iron won't mix with clay. I heard a Turkish minister several months ago said this of democracy. He said that it is the duty of every Muslim to embrace democracy in order to advance the goals of Islam. So think about that. Think of Islam and what you know of Sharia and the Quran. First of all, do you equate that with freedom of the press and free speech and free elections and liberties? No, you don't. The antithesis of that. And yet they say embrace democracy, which is supposedly about freedom of the press, freedom of the speech, free elections, etc. Embrace that in order to advance the other. One guy said it this way: democracy is merely the trolley you ride until you reach your destination. Well, the question then would be, what is the destination? In other words, it seems to me that we are now at a place in time where they are willing, that is Islam, the real Islam, not the one they put on television that is supposed to look so nice and moderate, but the real Islam, that they're willing to embrace something that is foreign to them, in fact something they associate with a culture that they say is devoid of any spiritual value, in order to advance their agenda. And guess who's more than willing to support them in that effort? But what's going to happen when they arrive at their destination? If democracy is merely the trolley they're going to ride until they reach their destination, what's going to happen when they reach their destination? Iron does not mingle with clay. Strength does not mingle with weakness. And when they come to that realization that this just doesn't, we can't do this anymore, which one's got to go and which one's going to stay? Now, let's go to Revelation 17 again, and we're going to kind of bring this to a close. The harlot who sits on many waters, she's got written on her forehead, mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, the abominations of the earth, her fornication, which represents mingling, has caused all the inhabitants of the earth with the wine of her fornication. All right, let's read on down. Let's see. This is kind of a footnote, but let's point something out in verse 8. John sees the woman and he sees the beast. And the angel tells him, I'm going to tell you the mystery of the woman and the beast. Two mysteries here. Verse 8, the beast that you saw was. Now what does that mean? It's in the past, right? Used to be. So the beast that you're looking at, John, used to be. It was in the past. Next phrase says, and is not. What does that mean? It's not here. By the way, in John's day, who was ruling the earth? Rome. So if the beast that he saw used to be, from his point of view, and is not in his day, and Rome was ruling in his day, what can I deduce? Rome is not the beast. Rome is perhaps the distraction, so that we won't be looking at Babylon. But we'll descend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition, and those who dwell on the earth will marvel whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world when they see the beast that was and is not and yet is. So who's going to marvel? Those whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. So what would the remez be? What would the hint be here? Sorry? Exactly. Thank you. Those whose names are written in the book aren't going to marvel. Why is that? Here's where Darush comes in. Line upon line, precept upon precept. Surely the Lord God does nothing except He first reveal His secret unto His servants, the prophets. There is nothing that has been hidden that will not be revealed. But you got to knock if you want the door to be opened up to you. You've got to seek if you're going to find. Agreed? So then, let's go on down to verse 12. The 10 horns which you saw on the beast are 10 kings. What were those 10 toes on those 2 feet, iron mingled with clay? They also were 10 kings. So the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. They are of one mind. Remember what they said of Babylon. They were of one language and one speech, which is to say they spoke the same language and they were of one mindset. They are of one mind and they will give their power and authority to the beast. It talks about them making war with the Lamb. We'll skip on down to verse 15. Then he said to me, the waters which you saw, where the harlot sits, are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. So the beast is not the woman, and the woman is not the beast. But they seem to be, at least for a little while, collaborating with one another, working together. Maybe we could even dare say mixing with one another. But look what happens. And the 10 horns which you saw on the beast, or the 10 kings, these will hate the harlot, make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh and burn her with fire. In other words, these 10 kings are going to destroy that woman who represents this mingled ideology, this mingled philosophy, this coexisting type way of thinking. And you see, she had committed fornication with the kings of the earth. And might I suggest that these 10 kings are part of those kings that she committed fornication with. And so it would seem that when they have used her for their purposes and she has outlasted her usefulness, what are they going to do? They're going to destroy her. Because, in other words, when iron discovers that clay doesn't mix with iron, which of the two is going to go? And so, if all these events in the Middle East, this so-called Arab Spring and all these democratic reform, again, a good thing, if that's being promoted by the West, I mean, think of it this way. If the world thinks it's a good thing, if the world thinks it's a good thing, how should I be viewing it? At the very least, with suspicion. But the West is promoting this. And this no-fly zone in Libya, for instance. Look, I'm not here to defend Muammar Gaddafi. But my thing is, okay, if you're going to go put a no-fly zone in Libya, where's the no-fly zone in Syria? If you're going to try to get rid of Muammar Gaddafi, are you sure the people who are going to take his place are something we can trust? Oh, as it turns out, they're Al-Qaeda. But are we supposed to be over them? And, oh, by the way, Osama bin Laden was in favor of the so-called Arab Spring. So isn't it interesting that we find ourselves promoting and supporting something that Osama bin Laden was all for? Because weren't we supposed to be at war with him? So I don't know how you feel about this, but it seems to me that we're, and I'm not just talking about a Democratic administration, but it started with a Republican administration. It started in Iraq, quite frankly, because George Bush's stated purpose for going into Iraq was to sow the seeds of democracy. It's a political agenda, ladies and gentlemen. Because it's a mixed and a mingled mindset. And so is it possible that as all these democratic reforms are taking place in the Middle East and the West is supporting it, that those in the Middle East are more than willing to embrace that support if it's going to advance their agenda? But what happens? What happens if they get to their destination and they realize they don't need support anymore? And what happens if in the process the West has made itself even more vulnerable by thinking that we can coexist? But Bill, that doesn't sound very tolerant. Right. It doesn't. Like I told you at the very beginning, based on the culture's definition of tolerance and based on what this book says, I can't be tolerant. Verse 17. Why do these 10 kings destroy this woman? For God has put it into their hearts to fulfill His purpose. So I glean from that His purpose is served when this woman is destroyed. Or shall we say, when this way of thinking is eradicated. It serves His purpose. And who does He use to fulfill His purpose? These 10 kings who are going to give their power to the beast. And so guess who else serves the Father's purpose? The beast. Nebuchadnezzar, He says, is My servant. And Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem, razed the temple, carried the princes of Judah and all the temple furnishings into captivity. And yet God says, He is my servant. Here's something else that maybe you haven't thought about. But even the adversary, when he's on the loose and when he's pursuing his agenda, in the end, guess what? He too is serving God's purpose. And so God has put it into their heart to do this, to fulfill His purpose, to be of one mind, and to give their kingdom to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And so even when they give their kingdom and their authority to the beast, that too is to fulfill God's purpose. So here's one last little thing. Actually, two last little things. Verse 18. And the woman you saw, and the woman whom you saw, is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Now, people read that and they say, aha, it's Rome. Because Rome was the city that was reigning over the kings of the earth. However, in verse 8, did we see that the beast that John saw used to be was not in his day, which means it wasn't Rome. Is that correct? So if it's not Rome in 8, how can it be Rome in verse 18? Can't be. And so who is that great city that reigns over the kings of the earth? If you have any doubts, just start reading chapter 18 of Revelation. It's Babylon. And so I'll conclude with this. It says that that great city rules the kings of the earth. And if this is all culminating in the last days, and if we are living in the last days, and I believe we are, then that means that right now, ladies and gentlemen, all the kings of the earth, all the leaders of the earth are being ruled and reigned by a Babylonian way of thinking. And so in June of 2009, the President of the United States goes to Cairo, Egypt. Kind of interesting in light of what's been going on. Goes to Cairo, Egypt, and he gives an address to the University of Cairo in an effort to initiate better relations between Islam and the United States. And in the course of his address, he said this, that Islam and America should not be considered exclusive to one another. In fact, they share overlapping values such as tolerance and social justice. Now, overlapping, you know what that suggests to me? Mixing. They share overlapping values like social justice and tolerance. In fact, he went on to say that Islam is part of America. Now, I'm a little bit of an amateur historian. And I can tell you that in all the years that I've studied history, I have not come across one time when any of the framers of the Constitution or any of the founding fathers quoted Muhammad or the Quran. The only thing I can come up with is Thomas Jefferson purchased a Quran because he wanted to get to know the Muslim people because he was about to wage war against them. Off the coasts of North Africa, the Barbary pirates, they were Muslim, they were Moorish, and they were raiding our merchant ships. And so, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, where in the Marine, that's what that's all about. And so he read the Quran in order to understand the enemy. But my point is this. Perhaps today, Islam is part of America. And I don't know about you, but that kind of frightens me. That kind of bothers me. And if it was to imply that Islam has always been part of America, then I will suggest that because that's not true, then what's being exploited is that this generation, my generation and younger, really don't know where we come from. And so if you don't know the truth, then there are people who can exploit your ignorance. My people perish for lack of knowledge. Now, here's what I really wanted you to hear, though. The course of the conversation or the speech came around to Jerusalem and Israel. Because it's always going to come around to Jerusalem because The Creator said, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling and a burdensome stone. And so when he got to Jerusalem, this is what the president said, that he envisioned Jerusalem being a city, and I quote, where all the children of Abraham, Muslims, Christians, and Jews, can mingle together in the way God intended it to be. As it is written in the story of Ithra, when Muhammad, Moses, and Jesus all prayed together, end quote. So his estimation, and not just his administration, but previous administrations and other governments of other countries, they envisioned Jerusalem being a mixed and mingled city. But isn't that what Babylon is supposed to be? In fact, Babylon's made of bricks, but Jerusalem is comprised of stone. You see, the one who came and sowed tares in the midst of the wheat was not content with just having a field of tares. He wanted to sabotage the wheat by mixing the tares with the wheat. And so the kings of the earth, the leaders of the nations, the men of renown, have a mindset that is oriented to Babylon. And they are propagating that mindset through the nations, to the peoples, to the degree that the peoples of the world, the inhabitants of the earth, are made drunk with the wine of her fornication. But the Creator is saying to His people this, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch the unclean thing. Don't stay close enough to reach out and touch it. But be separate. And you will be my sons and daughters, and I will be a father to you. Because ultimately, I believe it boils down to this. It's still true that God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever should believe in Him should not perish, but have everlasting life. You see, those people out there, most of them don't know what's about to happen. Most of them don't know the ship is sinking. Yeshua said that His coming would be like the days of Noah, when men were eating, drinking, marrying, and giving in marriage. In other words, going about their daily routine. But the reason that they were marrying, giving in marriage, eating and drinking, and not paying attention to the fact that Noah was preaching righteousness all this time is because they had mixed and mingled and could not discern clean from unclean. You know, the world, they look at all the things that are going on in the earth and say, what's happening? But they don't understand it. It's like the dream is given to Nebuchadnezzar, but Nebuchadnezzar didn't know what to do with it. The dream was given to Pharaoh, but Pharaoh didn't know what to do with it. He had to call on Joseph. So, I said I was going to close with the other, but I'm going to close with this. What would have happened if Pharaoh, in Genesis 41, when he has the dream, what would have happened if there was no Hebrew by the name of Joseph in the prison to call? In other words, what would have happened if Joseph had decided just once, I'm going to cave in and I'm going to be like everybody else and give Potiphar's wife's advances? If he had done that, then I think we can presume that he would not have gone to prison. And if he had not gone to prison, then he could not have met the cupbearer. And if he had not met the cupbearer, he could not have interpreted the cupbearer's dream. And if he doesn't interpret the cupbearer's dream, then the cupbearer can't later on tell Pharaoh there's a Hebrew guy down in prison that can interpret your dream. In other words, if Joseph had decided to mix and to mingle, it wouldn't have just been a consequence for him as an individual, but it would have been consequences for all of Israel. And so his obedience doesn't just benefit him as an individual. His obedience benefits all God's people. Likewise, when Nebuchadnezzar has his dream, what if Daniel and his three friends had decided, you know, we're in Babylon. What's wrong with eating the king's food? let's just go ahead and eat the king's food. And if they had given in to that, maybe that would have just been the first step in giving in to even more things. And if they had continued to give in to more things, what would have happened to their spiritual keenness when it came time to interpret this dream? Exactly. Wouldn't have been able to do it. And if Daniel hadn't interpreted the dream, well, some would say, well, big deal. So what? Well, then you and I couldn't be looking at Daniel and coming to understand what Daniel was trying to tell us about our day and time. You see, because surely the Lord God does nothing except He first revealed His secret to His servants, the prophets, because He wants His people to understand. Because in the end, He wants you and I to be equipped to do what we were placed here to do. And it's not to try to figure out who the Antichrist is. It's not to really to focus on what the adversary is doing. But in understanding that these things are happening, it is to provoke us to focus on Him, to understand what He is doing in the earth, that we might fulfill our purpose for being here. We have certainly come into the kingdom for such a time as this. So, Yeshua said this, "There will be sign in the sun, moon, and stars on the earth, distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them from knowledge and fear of the things that are coming upon the earth, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. But when you see these things begin to happen, look up, lift up your head, for your redemption is at hand." And if these things are indeed happening, then it is our cue to look up, to focus on Him, to lift up our heads, to pay attention to what He's saying, because our redemption is at hand.